Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. In recent years, war, violence, and poverty have forced millions of people to migrate internally within their own country or cross international borders. The climate crisis is also forcing people to move. According to a new investigation from the New York Times and ProPublica, 1% of the world is a barely livable hot zone today. By 2070, that portion could go up to 19%. According to the investigation, as their land fails them, hundreds of millions of people from Central America to Sudan will be forced to choose between flight or death. The result will almost certainly be the greatest wave of global migration the world has ever seen. Joining us to discuss the Great Climate Migration Report is Abram Lustgarten, a senior reporter for ProPublica. Hi, Abram. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So your piece ran in the New York Times Magazine a couple weeks ago. It's also up at the ProPublica site. You at ProPublica and the New York Times joined forces with the Pulitzer Center to model how people will move across borders for the very first time. Tell us how you and your colleagues put together this model.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, I've been covering climate for a number of years now, and we were interested in this question of, you know, how people will begin to respond to their changing climate in places where it is just less and less likely to be, very habitable to live. So the hypothesis that there would be some sort of forced migration. But as you begin to report on migration issues, you quickly learn that it's an incredibly complicated issue where, you know, personal decision-making is, the result of lots of subtle and not so subtle factors. And the research on, you know, how climate weighs into that is, it shows that it's a pervasive but a subtle influence. So, you know, it's, things aren't black and white. It's rarely the case that you can just say, oh, hot climate forces people to move. So the question came up for us about how you might use a computer model or almost an artificial intelligence system to try to ask enough questions and run enough scenarios that you might be able to detect some of those subtle influences. And I think it's a fascinating experiment and maybe an imperfect process, but also just gave us some pretty revolutionary insight into, you know, what might happen. There were similar models that looked at how people would move within countries. The World Bank had developed something that did that, looked at how populations would respond to climate and move within their borders. And we worked with the same researchers who built that model to just expand it and to begin to look at how people would then move across borders and out of countries and across larger distances, given changes in socioeconomic development and given changes in climate, and using standard measures that the United Nations uses in their climate research.
Let's talk about some of the facts that we do know now. According to a path-breaking recent study in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the planet could see a greater temperature increase in the next 50 years than it did in the last 6,000 years combined. That is hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah, so this is really an incredible study, and it didn't necessarily focus on migration per se, but it's so applicable. And what it basically found is that for the past 6,000 years, that humans have existed in basically a narrow band of temperatures on the planet. That's to say, we've always had a preference for a certain temperature zone, and we've generally lived within that temperature zone and thrived in that temperature zone around the globe. Not universally, there's always exceptions, but the vast majority of the global population. And it's that zone, what they call sort of that niche climate, that those researchers found is going to shift dramatically, both north and south, but there's more land mass to the north. So we talk about, the zone mostly shifting north. And what that means is, by default, that either, you know, they projected to 2070 when the population of the planet might be about 9 billion people. Mm-hmm. So either the majority of those, about a third of those 9 billion people move to stay within that niche, which means they migrate, or they stay where they are, which means that they'll be living, you know, in a temperature range that's historically inhospitable for people. And it'll be, you know, most likely the future will include both of those scenarios, some combination of it, but neither one looks particularly, status quo.
Another study conducted in 2017 in Science Advances found that by the year 2100, temperatures could rise to the point that just going outside for a couple of hours in some places, including parts of India and eastern China, quote, will result in death even for the fittest of humans.
Yeah, that's right. So increasingly climate researchers are measuring not just temperature, the kind of temperature that we look to a thermometer to see, but what they call wet bulb temperature, which is really a combination of both temperature and humidity, as well as other things like solar radiation and exposure and things like that. And they came up with a measure for wet bulb temperature that is a scale of essentially how able the human body is to cool itself. So, at about 95 degrees, Fahrenheit wet bulb temperature, humans can't survive outside for more than about 6 hours, this study found. Even at about 82 degrees, they become extremely strained, increased risk of heat stroke, difficult to participate in athletics, difficult to maintain, sort of basic health or outdoor labor. So that temperature range will be reached, fairly consistently around the planet, within the next couple of decades. And at its most extreme, what I mentioned in this paper is that 95 degree threshold, that unsurvivable temperature, will affect parts of Asia, parts of South Asia in particular, and maybe other places by, well before the end of the century.
So is the model based on this data?
The model is based on some of this data and lots of other data. So the model is a combination of a number of models that the United Nations researchers use. One set is for what they call socioeconomic pathways, and those are a set of scenarios that consider, everything from how relatively open borders are to, how corrupt or non-corrupt governments are. To climate information, population change, economic activity, and so forth. And the other set of models are around climate change itself. So, what we call the representative concentration pathways for how much carbon dioxide will be in the atmosphere. And there's a scale of those from quite pessimistic worst-case scenarios to quite optimistic. And they basically are a measure for how much the climate will change. And so, the models, they include other additional environmental factors where we were able to find data, but basically they take those two data sets that I just described and they combine them to look at how under certain socioeconomic scenarios and certain climate scenarios, how people would be most likely to move based on how people moved in response to some of those changing conditions in the past. So the model is trained by historical action and then projects that action into the future.
So, for example, and there are so many in the piece, the projected number of migrants arriving from Central America and Mexico rises to 1.5 million a year by 2050 from about 700,000 a year in 2025. Also, people are already beginning to flee in Southeast Asia, where there's unpredictable monsoon rainfall and droughts. They've made farming so much more difficult. And the model says that more than 8 million people have moved toward the Middle East, Europe, and North Africa. I mean, there's just so many examples, Abram, about people moving. And you write that the best outcome requires not only goodwill and the careful management of turbulent political forces. Without preparation and planning, the sweeping scale of change could prove wildly destabilizing. The UN and others warn that in the worst case scenarios, the governments of the nations most affected by climate change could topple as whole regions devolve into war.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, what we see is that migration in response to climate is already happening, as you just said. We know, climate will be one of many factors that drives a large number of people to migrate around the world, as they always have. But as the climate warms, the proportion of people who move because of climate will increase. And what researchers know already about migration is that when it happens in very, very large numbers, it's unsettling. It stresses communities and governments and urban systems in ways that either require extraordinary anticipation and preparation or can just be very unsettling. Not enough jobs, not enough fresh water, not enough sanitation, or sewage systems, for example. Competition for resources can lead to conflict. Mixing of ethnic groups leads to increased conflict and so forth. unless there is, you know, enough preparation to make some of these transitions go more smoothly. And our model doesn't predict all of this. And as the article states, I mean, the model itself is, you know, is imperfect and imprecise for its exact numbers, but it does help, you know, confirm what the other research describes and give a general sense of the trajectory, which is that the numbers will be increasing, that the numbers of people who move vary greatly between different socioeconomic conditions. That's to say, like, you know, how much economic development happens or doesn't happen in the equatorial regions of the planet will affect how many people, you know, move out of there. And those things in turn will affect, you know, the stability and, you know, the relative wellness of the places to the north that receive those large populations.
You also write about, you know, what will happen if governments prepare or don't prepare for this. And you write that as refugees stream out of the Middle East and North Africa into Europe and from Central America into the United States, an anti-immigrant backlash has propelled nationalist governments into power around the globe. The alternative, driven by a better understanding of how and when people will move, is governments that are actively preparing, both materially and politically, for these massive changes that are coming.
Yeah, so this is really, you know, I think the key question, right, and an unanswerable question. I mean, what we can see is that a relatively small number of migrants, you know, into Europe out of the Syrian conflict and out of the Arab Spring, you know, North African states over the last decade, had a pretty extraordinarily destabilizing influence on Europe. It still is now. I mean, that influx of migration is, you know, partially, you know, what has led to Brexit in the UK. It's led to, you know, an anti-immigrant backlash in Italy. You know, and the shining example of, you know, of attempting to accept and, you know, and benefit from this movement of people is, you know, what Germany has done. And politically, Germany has seen, you know, I think, the, you know, the jury's out. It looks like there's an economic benefit for Germany, but socially, they've seen a rise in, you know, conservative political groups, you know, who object to the influx of migrants, and that's a real backlash, and shows some of the consequences politically for, you know, this sort of thorny decision-making. But these decisions are going to have to be made by the U.S., by Canada, by European countries, by Russia, by China, you know, every place that, you know, is north of the most populated and hottest parts of the world.
And you point out that this is a major test, and COVID really has offered a test on whether humanity has the capacity to avert a predictable and predicted catastrophe. As you write, some countries have fared better, but the United States has completely failed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, climate change is that big test, right? And migration related to climate change is a big test, and it's part of that. But so, you know, controlling the decline of biodiversity in the planet and, you know, and all of the other things that go along with climate change. But what COVID teaches us is, you know, we have a predicted risk that a pandemic would come, predicted consequences, which turned out to be, you know, quite realistic. We knew all of this many, many years in advance. We attempted or didn't try hard enough to have systems in place to meet it, and now met with it. Like I said, I mean, we in the United States have failed, and it's a challenge globally. But this is such a small challenge compared to what climate change presents and what my research found that migration will present. That it's really, you know, this should be a wake up call. If we follow the same patterns of greeting enormous challenges the way we have, in the future, we have, you know, no chance of adapting, you know, to the issues that they present, or we can, you know, take a more proactive, approach with greater investment and more foresight and, you know, at least make a good stab at being ready for the changes that are going to be headed our way.
Today we're speaking with Abram Lustgarten, a senior reporter at ProPublica and the New York Times. put together this major investigation called The Great Climate Migration. You can find a link to this article at yourcallradio.org. This is going to be an ongoing series. According to this investigation, 1% of the world is a barely livable hot zone today. By 2070, that portion could go up to 19%. If you have any questions for Abram, now would be a good time to call. He's going to be with us for the next 10 minutes. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's spend the remaining 10 minutes talking about who's going to be most affected and then what solutions this model comes up with. Because, I mean, the numbers about the number of people who are projected to live in slums is just so overwhelming. And we know that this is just going to affect the poorest people on the planet. You write that in just a decade, 4 out of every 10 urban residents, 2 billion people around the world will live in slums. Right now, a little more than half of the planet's population lives in urban areas, but by the middle of the century, this model predicts 67% will. I mean, this is just such a huge number, Abram, and this is just affecting the poorest people on the planet.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, again, as with the broader, you know, climate change impact, the majority of the pain will be felt by, the poorest and, least fortunate people on the planet. What you're describing, this rapid urbanization is, it's a classic planning, and development challenge. And it's one that climate change is, like it does for so many things, is just going to make happen faster and make much more, urgent, and the consequences perhaps much worse. But that is what we see as it gets hotter, as places get drier, rural areas will have, a more difficult time farming, and sustaining themselves. And providing a basic food supply. And as they do that, and as the people in those places both seek food and greater economic opportunity, they will continue to move to cities as they have for decades now. And this is, the same pattern that we see in the United States, as we see in Guatemala, as we see in, the Sahel of North Africa. But those cities, again, without planning and without very, very large targeted investments, will have a difficult time, receiving and providing for that influx of population. And that's where you get the growth of the slums. So when you have, poor people moving into cities that can't find work and can't find sanitary conditions, they make a place for themselves to live. And it's usually in the outskirts of, of the more urban and more developed areas. And these slums, our models project, will grow, and, spatially, geographically, the models show, basically a ring around the wealthier, more metropolitan part of global cities. We looked, at Central American cities. But that ring of least wealthy people will grow, and it's in those rings then that people are, so they have dirtier conditions, immense poverty. Those become the hotbed recruitment grounds for whether it's, terrorism or anti-establishment groups or challenges to local governments or to other forms of conflict, they usually, gestate in those sorts of communities, not to mention the immense suffering that happens in those communities. And then migration is either an outlet valve for that, or not. There's lots of things that are needed to help remedy that situation, from allowing migration to investing in people where they are before they migrate.
Did this World Bank model factor in other issues like social and economic forces? Because as we know, the World Bank has supported neoliberal policies that also contribute to the reason why a lot of people are leaving. For example, you look at trade policies. So, because it's not just the climate crisis. Of course, the climate crisis is horrific and it's causing a lot of people to flee. But there are also many economic reasons why people are fleeing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. These issues become inseparable. They're so intertwined and braided together that at some point it becomes difficult to distinguish, even what is the driving factor. So the World Bank model, and then you know our version of it, it does attempt to incorporate you know as many of those you know complexities as possible. So economic growth for sure, things like political stability, political opportunity, indexes for corruption, even indexes for violence, things like that. And that's all in recognition that these things become intertwined. And, you know, one example of how we can see in the model that they're intertwined, but can't, you know, quite pinpoint the exact causes in some of our findings, which show that, you know, overall migration from Central America to the United States grows every year, regardless of climate, but it grows more and it grows faster as the climate gets warmer. So there is some degree of influence that climate is having on those overall migration figures, even if we can't attribute that migration to climate. But when we ask the model to try to isolate, you know, the number of those migrants that we might say are moving exclusively or close to exclusively for climate-related reasons, and you know, have a less braided cause and effect, that number drops dramatically to, you know, to about 5%, which I should say is still a huge number when you're talking about the populations of whole countries. But the point is, we can only say that a very small fraction are moving only or will move only because of climate. The vast majority will move because they seek economic opportunity or because there's crime or violence in their, you know, in their home residence areas. But the climate will become, you know, one more push factor or one more straw, you know, that eventually, you know, breaks the proverbial back and forces them to move.
And there's a huge concern about solutions around this because so many wealthy countries, again, have caused a lot of these problems. I mean, when you think about NAFTA and what it did to Mexican farmers, I mean, it was just devastating. So it's you don't want to get to the point where a lot of poor countries and poor people are relying, quote unquote, on wealthy countries to help them when in many cases they caused a lot of these problems in the first place.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, there's an environmental justice component to climate change itself, and it comes up in almost all of my interviews with, you know, with global migration experts or with representatives from the United Nations. You know, and that's the sense that not only, of course, you know, to use the United States as an example, but, it can be any of our developed countries, you know, but we have a small proportion of the global population and are responsible for a great, much larger proportion of global emissions. And if you look at how those emissions have caused the sort of climate changes that are, you know, beginning to affect crop production or water availability in places like rural Guatemala, you know, then you can see that our actions here are responsible for, you know, their struggles there. And there, you know, there is a connection and there's a movement, you know, in the climate community to try to address that in some way, either, you know, to justify investments in those countries to help people, you know, continue to farm or grow the food that they need or to help them adapt, through, you know, greater mobility to their own cities or out of countries if they move, and so forth. But there's definitely a widespread view that the developed world bears responsibility for what's happening in the developing world now.
Right. And it's also important to ensure that the voices of the people on the ground in those countries have a seat at the table.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, it's one of the most challenging aspects, of course, you know, to take Guatemala as an example. You know, there's a lot of very committed and very brilliant researchers and academics and some in politics who are pushing on these issues and seeking various forms of progress. But they remain still, you know, kind of an overall minority. And what was fascinating to me, you know, is as you really move into the most rural communities, the most isolated, in my case, you know, indigenous Mayan communities high in the mountains, mm-hmm. You know, there is still, you know, a lack of understanding of what some of the larger forces are, you know, that the suffering that they experience in their farm fields, not being able to grow a crop of maize, is part of a larger, you know, shift that's affecting their entire country and affecting their entire continent and affecting the entire world. There is still a lot of awareness to be gained, and that sort of awareness can, you know, will lead to greater understanding and greater action. But you can't, expect that every person affected, has a good understanding yet of what the larger dynamics are that are determining their fate at this point.
Well, I know we have to let you go, and I just want to say the story that you told about Jorge and his son was just really incredible. I mean, this is just one of so many stories, and the photos are also really incredible. So thank you for this piece, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for your interest. It's a privilege to be able to talk about it.
Thank you. Abram Lesgarden is a senior reporter at ProPublica. They teamed up with the New York Times to come out with a piece called The Great Climate Migration. This is the first of three reports. You can find a link at yourcallradio.org, and I hope you can take some time to read it because they did focus on specific people, including Jorge, who left Guatemala with his son. He made it to the United States last spring, climbing the steel border barrier, dropping his seven-year-old son 20 feet down the other side into the California desert. They now live in Houston. We're going to take a quick break. Coming up, we will talk about this year's International Ocean Film Festival, and this year they are going online. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.